touch bar there. See if I go here.
We're going to call to order the Senate Education Committee for March 23rd, 2017. And we're going to do one, what would I call it, cleanup before we get started. And that has to do, we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 905. This is a bill that was supposed to go to Judiciary. It came here accidentally. They got one of our bills. We're switching places now. So we're going to, without, I would like a motion, though, without recommendation to send.
Chair Roblin, I'd be happy to help you clean up your life. Okay. I move Senate Bill 905 without recommendation back to the President's office for referral to another committee.
Senator Lithgow moves Senate Bill 905 without recommendation back to the President's office. Did I do that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Is there any discussion?
We do the rest of the bills that way, too.
Exactly. Is there any opposition to this? Seeing none, I hope it has a nice life someplace else. So with that, we're going to close our work session on Senate Bill 905. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 136. With that, we'll have a short explanation, and I'll have our illustrious, esteemed senator come forward to give us a conversation, Senator Monroe. So first we'll hear it.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 136 makes changes to Senate Bill 1537 from 2016. It moves the repeal date of the postgraduate scholar program from June 30, 2021 to June 30, 2019. It requires a report by the Oregon Department of Education required under Oregon Laws 2016, Chapter 109, to include recommendations for funding mechanisms that do not draw from the state school fund. After July 1, 2021, it prohibits school districts from paying for community college expenses for postgraduate scholars, declares an emergency effective on passage.
And with that, Senator Monroe.
I am Senator Rod Monroe, District 24. That's mid-Multnomah County and some of northern Clackamas County. Thank you, esteemed Senator Roblin, Senator Lithicum, and members of the Education Committee. It's been a long time since I served on the Education Committee. This Senate Bill 136 deals with the Postgraduate Scholars Program. A few years ago, some districts started paying essentially for the first year of college for students that had completed their high school work but had not actually been handed a diploma. For example, in 2013 and 2014, there were 948 students in various school districts in this program. The next year it went up to 1,298. Then we made some adjustments to try and scale back and ratchet down this program so that last year there were only 120 students in this program. Part of that change that we made was, of course, passage of the Oregon Promise by, you know, which Senator Haas kind of came up with. The problem with this program is that it has been funded out of the state school fund. State school fund is designed for K-12, not for 13, not for the first year of college. And so what this bill simply does is finally closes the door on this program and asks that additional funding sources not out of the state school fund be used for these postgraduate scholar programs. I am looking for every penny I can find as chair of the Ed Sub for the state school fund. We all want to fund education at a higher level, but taking some of the K-12 money out for a post-scholars program is simply inappropriate. Let's wrap this up and end it. It's been ratcheted way down, so it won't be a great hardship on anybody. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Any questions for the senator?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would just say that the great hardship would be to the 132 that are left that can't get into the Oregon Promise because they have a grade point average that's below 2.5. They tend to be foster kids, homeless kids, kids that are in recovery, kids that have come out of juvenile justice, and I mean, it really is a transformational program for them, and without a door to them, and without a different pathway to keep them in. I know a number of those students are actually in Corvallis that are there, where they've literally gone and taken kids out from living underneath bridges, brought them back in with like a 0.5 grade point average, helped them get through their high school diploma and provided them the support in that year. I think I heard from Corvallis earlier this year that their average grade point average of the kids that were postgraduate scholars leaving high school was somewhere below 2.0, but after their first semester of community college, their average GPA was something like 3.8. So it's, I mean, they really have kind of wrapped services around them, and right now there isn't another way to pull these kids in because Oregon Promise isn't serving them.
And this bill simply says, look for other ways, don't rob the common school fund. These kids certainly need an education. I hear from students all the time that are not eligible for the Oregon Promise because their grade point average is a little below the 2.5 threshold. I'd love to serve them, but we're not even serving all of the students that are eligible that have above a 2.5. We're having to fight to come up with the additional money just to fund those students. And so to open it up to other students, and particularly to take money out of the common school fund, is inappropriate. We need to find a better way to help these kids and to help them go on to their education. I want to make one thing perfectly clear. This program has nothing to do with the traditional fifth-year students. When I was going to high school, and I'm sure when you all were going to high school, occasionally students didn't get their credits in time for graduation at the end of their senior year and had to come back and go a fifth year to get those credits. This bill does nothing to do with those students. They could absolutely be funded out of the Common School Fund in the traditional fifth-year program. But once they've graduated, once they've finished all their high school-level work, it's inappropriate for additional education to be paid for out of the school fund.
So I only have one statement first, is to say I am very pleased with the work that was done when we worked on both of these bills, because one of the things that we were asking was to make sure we cut down the program, and it exceeded the expectation. I from my perspective, the fact that there are 130 is much better, and so I thank Senator Gelser for coming up with the sideboards that made that happen. It's much lower than I thought it was going to be. I was surprised when I got the numbers, and I agree with you. And it's possible. I think we need to maybe also do a study to find out how many of these 120 kids already had their diploma or not, because I think some of them, they probably are listed in this program, but those classes they're taking are going to help them get that fifth year done. So there may be some of those that are in there too, so we can look at that and see.
And this bill allows this year to finish,
right,
and one more year.
Okay. Any questions? And I know we've had the conversation about if we can figure out how to afford it, looking at Promise and figuring out where it is. I think there's a dual thing with that. Part of it is setting out an expectation so that people will aspire to that and work hard to get the 2.5.
Yeah.
There's another reason for figuring out maybe there's some exceptions to people who have had a 2.5 in the last 2 years, but they couldn't get it up for that last year.
And we funded Oregon Promise at only $10 million, and we're finding out that a lot more students are jumping into it, which made me pleased in many ways. I'm sure Senator Haas, the author of this program, was pleased as well, except now we've got to come up with perhaps another $40 million to fund even the first year of this program.
And it's been, the other thing about Promise, which I think is really good, is that it has a completion rate. The kids that go on term after term of almost 90%, which is unheard of in community colleges. So there's a lot of positive things about that too. So
we've done a lot of good things.
Yes, we have. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else that would like to talk to Senate Bill 136? You don't all have to come at the same time. So with that, we're going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 136. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 278. We'll have a short explanation by our administrator.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 278 requires the Oregon Department of Education to study the effect of school social workers on attendance rates, harassment, bullying, morale, and the school system as a whole. It requires ODE to submit a report to an interim committee of the legislature related to education by October 15, 2018, and a second report by October 15, 2019. It requires ODE to create a pilot program to increase the number of students served by school social workers, consisting of distributing funds for the hiring of new social workers, increasing the working hours of existing school social workers, or enabling existing school personnel to earn licenses as school social workers.
So we're going to invite Keenan Ginsburg.
There's a dash two amendment.
She'll talk about that when you get up here. And Angelica Serena and Ellen Baltus, come on up. And dash two amendment.
The dash two amendment removes language relating to the morale of students and staff. It removes provisions adding school social workers to portions of state law pertaining to behavioral health. Clarifies that annual report required of participants in the pilot program will not be submitted until October 15th, 2018. It removes appropriations from the general fund and appropriates $24 million from the high school graduation and college and career readiness fund created by Measure 98 for the study and pilot program.
Okay. Let's hear what social workers do and why they would make a difference
why
in schools.
So well.
You want to go first or me?
Sure. Doesn't matter.
You go.
Okay. Chair Roblin and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to talk louder.
Say your name.
Oh, sorry. My name is Ellen Baltus, and I received my master's in social work. Do you want me to say where I'm from first? Do that whole
it's
thing.
Okay.
Okay. My name is Ellen Baltus, and I received my master's in social work 32 years ago. I'm a licensed clinical social worker and, as of 2 years ago, a licensed school social worker. I am one of the founding members and present treasurer for the Oregon School Social Work Association. I've been working in the schools for the last 25 years as a child development specialist. I appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of this bill, as I have been concerned for some time about the lack of school social workers in schools despite the need. Some of the critical strengths trained and experienced social workers can bring to schools are knowledge of trauma-informed approaches, mental health expertise, and social systems perspective when working with students, families, and school communities. These and other strengths social workers bring to school are described in more detail in documents submitted to you in OLIS.
Perfect.
Like me, many social workers come into schools having previous experience doing social work in the community. These experiences can provide an invaluable expertise to their work when in schools. I can think of social workers in my district alone who have previous work as family skills trainers, drug and alcohol treatment therapists, psychiatric hospital and day treatment workers, and juvenile court workers. The school where I work now is a Title I elementary school in Milwaukee, Oregon, where all students receive free and reduced lunch, and about 40% of the nearly 500 students' first language is Spanish. Many are new immigrants to the United States. My school has 25% of its students on individualized education plans, many with an eligibility of emotional disturbance. My elementary school has one of the highest rates of students experiencing homelessness and has one of the highest rates of annual child abuse reporting in my district. We know from the trauma research that children with a great number of traumatic events are 2.5 times more likely to fail a grade, score lower on standardized tests, have more expressive or receptive language difficulties, are suspended or expelled more often, and are designated to special ed more often. On a daily basis, I hear stories of trauma from children that involve violence in their homes, abuse, deportation, family incarceration, drug and alcohol addiction, multiple forms of loss. Because building relationships and trust is the core to our school's success, it means most of my staff are also hearing these stories. Recently, a couple days ago, a 9-year-old student who had recently been returned to her mother from foster care and was living now in a new Central City Concerned Sober Living apartment complex came to school in tears, unable to get started in class. She reported to her teacher that she was afraid her mother was going to die. She had noticed she had self-inflicted cuts on her arms. My trauma training taught me how to support and reassure her and her teacher in the moment with a sense of confidence and calm that the adults would take care of this and that we would support her mom. My mental health experience knew how to respond to those who engage in cutting behaviors, and so I was comfortable calling her mom, with whom I'd already developed a relationship, to discuss the concern. Because of my systems perspective and previous drug and alcohol treatment experience, I also knew how to strategize a plan that included utilizing the support system in a residential sober living community to help her talk to her daughter with supports that evening. I continued working with the family in the weeks and months that followed with positive effects on this. Oh, that's another situation. The next day she came to school and she was much happier and pleased that someone had spoke to her mom and she was ready to learn. Another example of a situation in which social workers was best suited to address the problem, I once worked with a 10-year-old student who came up to her teacher during Mass saying she couldn't concentrate because her mom's boyfriend kept touching them last night. I knew I'd already trained that staff on how to respond to a child reporting sexual abuse. I had already taught sexual abuse prevention, including how to tell an adult you trust to that student in the classroom. With my mental health training and child welfare background, I knew how to emotionally support the staff, student, and family before, during, and after the child abuse reporting process. These are some of the stories I, my staff, and many educators experience on a regular basis in the schools, especially in our high poverty schools. To improve school achievement and school attendance, we can no longer look at the student in isolation from their family, culture, and community that influenced them. We must see and intervene on the why behind the tears, the absenteeism, the oppositional behavior, the low achievement. By being part of the school culture on a daily basis, families and students have come to trust me. They know me as Mrs. B. This allows me to uncover what barrier a child may truly be experiencing that is interfering with their education. The why is usually some form of trauma that is likely complex and rooted in multiple systems and/or mental health concerns. Social worker training with expertise in effective trauma response, mental health, and a systems perspective is ideal for understanding this. I'm very thrilled to see efforts in the Oregon legislature to increase the role of social workers in schools. I know from my early work in child welfare and my present work in schools that our approach works, especially for our most vulnerable students and families. Please join me in supporting Senate Bill 278.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Kenan Ginsberg. I'm a licensed school social worker. My title is called Attendance Specialist for the David Douglas School District. The David Douglas School District is a district known for its high poverty rate, its high need, its high cultural diversity, but most importantly to us here, it is known for providing students and their families with an outstanding education that is closing the achievement gap, passionately addressing the issue of chronic absenteeism, so say I, and graduating students prepared to take on the world. When caring and intelligent staff in our schools, like principals and counselors, have tried but not been successful at reaching our most complicated and most hurt families, the attendance teams in my buildings ask me to attempt to reach these families. The first thing that I do is work to build a bond and a relationship. I use this connection to allow me the opportunity to talk to my families about the issues of attendance and how they can address it to help their children succeed in school. Without this bond and without the training that helps me to establish that relationship, none of this message would be reaching our families. I love my job because I love the opportunity to work with families who know that they are not succeeding and who very much want to make sure that they do not repeat the same mistakes for their children that so commonly were their own experience in their own childhood. I'm here on behalf of the National Association of Social Workers Oregon Chapter, a professional association representing over 1,500 Oregon social workers, and I'm here to urge you to support Senate Bill 278, which would increase the number of public school students who are served by school social workers. There's a great need for social workers in schools. I'm sure you know that schools today are some of the front lines in America. Schools are where we learn about poverty, housing, and homelessness. Schools are where we learn about health and mental health issues that families are facing, where we learn about drug and alcohol dependency issues, and where we learn about the trauma and violence that may exist in some of our families' lives. A modern understanding of attendance and graduation issues also belongs here. We used to use ninth grade attendance rates as predictors of high school graduation rates. We did better research and then we began using third grade reading levels as a metric for how well students are going to graduate. We then did better research and we used kindergarten attendance rates and found that they actually as well can predict high school graduation rates. And we actually use R for K, which are ready for kindergarten metrics now, that show that families who are ready for kindergarten are delivering students into school ready to go through the process and to achieve. What this tells us is that the families who are struggling to have their kids ready for school are the families that we are going to need to reach and help the most. Being able to look earlier than the schooling years and to understand the obstacles that lead to attendance issues and the life challenges and complications that these families are facing will be the real solution. As a licensed school social worker leading the charge for a better way to address the chronic absenteeism issue we face in our state and in our nation, I'm here to tell you that the real obstacles to attendance are most often the issues that exist in the realm of the social worker. The issues are social work issues, and the solutions should be social work solutions. Senate Bill 278 is a response and a solution to an identified need. The state of Oregon has already identified the need to address student outcomes such as increasing graduation rates and decreasing rates of absenteeism. The state has also found that teachers are increasingly being asked to take care of children's needs that go beyond their skill and expertise. This has placed a concerning burden on teachers, and the state has rightly expressed concern for the welfare, for their welfare. Passing Senate Bill 278 will increase the number of school social workers and thus increase the number of students and families who can access them. When you pass Senate Bill 278, you can expect the following outcomes. We will improve attendance. We will improve housing stability and social service supports. We will improve parent-school relations. We will provide relief for the teachers who have tried but lack the training and the tools to address these issues. And all of this will lead to improved academics and a return to the pathway that leads to graduation. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you.
Chairman Roblin and members of the committee, my name is Angelica Serna, and I'm actually an assistant principal in the North Clackamas School District. And prior to that, I was a teacher in Gresham and Woodburn for 12 years. I taught kindergarten, second, and third grade for a total of 12 years. I've been fortunate in my career to work with very skilled child development specialists that have their master's in social work. I would first like to speak as a teacher to the importance of having skilled social workers in our school. As a teacher, I have leaned on and learned from the child development specialists in my school how to better support students and families, especially around outside factors that impact their learning. In a classroom often of 30 plus, we work hard to build a safe community, yet for some students, doing this in a large group does not meet their needs. As a teacher, I would think to myself, I'm differentiating, scaffolding, and creating a space that meets their needs. Why are they not growing, either academically or socially? Many times it was because of outside factors such as mental health, family crisis, or other trauma that I was not aware of. Not because I didn't care or did not have a relationship with a student or family. I did. But one-on-one time is rare for a teacher and student. I oftentimes would call upon my child development specialist to come check in with a student who seemed off, only to hear that a student had then shared any numerous problems from abuse, sex abuse, loss of housing, just to name a few. When a student did share with me, I still needed support around how to best support students with these problems due to the fact that I have not had in-depth training in mental health. I learned working with them, it was about understanding the child as a whole, not just the student in my classroom. Because social workers are trained mental health professionals, they are the experts that we need to ask the right questions, have the hard conversations, all in an effort to support and connect students, families, and schools. Unfortunately, at this time, not all schools have full-time child development specialists who are often social workers or counselors. In my new role, I see more than ever the need to have skilled social workers in our schools. Students are coming to school impacted more and more by trauma that is impacting them socially and academically. They and their families are needing more support to access their learning. An example of this is I am in charge of attendance at one of my schools. Parents come in to talk to me after a student has missed numerous days. In a recent meeting with a parent, she shared how her mom had overdosed on opiates, she had been fired from her job, was going to lose housing, and the father of her two girls had relapsed on opiates. I did not have the training to respond to this mom in a way that a social worker could and did. She was aware of housing supports, drug and alcohol recovery resources, mental health support for the children, just to name a few. As a result of this support, the student has had one absence since this meeting, and the mom has shared and reached out to the social worker on a regular basis when she needs help. If I didn't have a social worker in my building on a regular basis, this opportunity would have been missed, and the student would be the one that had suffered. It is important that social workers be a part of the school community and culture. Ongoing communication with teachers and other staff is vital to support students and families. Social workers work with staff, providing them with essential information to better understand factors affecting a student's performance and behavior. What I hope the committee takes away from my testimony is that today in school, especially schools that are high poverty, social workers need to be a part of every school community. It is vital that students' needs are met on a holistic level. Social workers have the training to be able to work within school systems to provide services to enhance students' emotional well-being and improve their academic performance. That is what I want for all students, that they would leave us prepared mentally, socially, and academically to be successful.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this group? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And so now we will call up Laura Neeson and Jenny Bergman. And Karen Apgar. And if you've turned in your testimony or put it online, then you don't need to read the whole thing. You can paraphrase it because we're going to have to get it, and we've got a bunch more people that want to get here. So with that, go ahead.
Chair Roblin and members of the committee, good afternoon, and thank you so much for considering this bill. My name is Jenny Bergmans, and I am a school social worker. I currently serve as the Family Services Manager for Community Action Head Start in Washington County. I supervise 7 family services assistants that provide parent engagement and resources for our high-needs families throughout Washington County. They also help children and families who have barriers to school attendance. When a child has been absent, teachers notify the family services assistants, and they will attempt to build a rapport with the family and work with the family to access resources so that they can get their child back to school. With this model, we have seen the tremendous impact that working with a child's family can have on a child's success. Parent engagement is a pivotal piece of the Head Start mission. This is because we know that when parents are involved in their child's education, he or she is more likely to succeed. We also realize that children can only be ready to learn if they have their basic needs met and are not in fight or flight mode. We cannot teach the head when the heart is broken or the mind is troubled. Unfortunately, our schools are becoming increasingly more frightening for our children every day. When children go to school, they have to face the fear that they might be bullied, sexually harassed, or even shot. Our children have to deal with all of this fear on top of whatever adverse experiences that they may be dealing with at home. Research has shown that if children have adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs, they will be more likely to have medical issues in the future. ACEs may include traumatic experiences such as parental separation, having a parent with a mental illness, substance abuse issue or who is incarcerated, domestic violence in the home, physical abuse, and/or sexual abuse. The more adverse childhood experiences that a child has, the higher likelihood they have of becoming ill. The effects adverse childhood experiences may have on the future include things such as heart disease, cancer, mental illness, immune disorders, obesity, and even suicide. This is why prevention is key. As a past Child Protective Services worker, I can tell you that these issues are hidden, but they are running rampant throughout our communities and neighborhoods, rich and poor. If we are able to ameliorate children's adverse childhood experiences, we will save a vast amount of money in the future on things such as healthcare and drug treatment. Social workers are highly educated in trauma-informed practices and adverse childhood experiences. They are also specially trained in working with systems and family issues. For these reasons, they are essential to have in our schools. Social workers will work with students and their families to resolve social, emotional, and behavioral problems. School social workers bring unique knowledge and skills to the school system. They can also help parents, students, and school staff identify needs that interfere with learning and work with students so that they can get the services that they need. Having social workers in schools will help to ameliorate adverse childhood experiences, keep our children safer, and will help our children and our communities to thrive. Having social workers in our schools will also save us money in the long haul. Please join me in supporting Senate Bill 278. Thank you.
Thank you. Whoever's next.
Hi. Good afternoon. My name is Laura Nissen, and I am a dean and professor of social work at Portland State University, and a proud social worker and connected to all of these folks who are our alums speaking today. I guess I want to start by just thanking you all. Now a lot of people know that the Oregon State Legislature started the School of Social Work 54 years ago to provide social work services and expertise to the people of the state of Oregon. So thank you for creating us. And I think we're fulfilling that duty today by, I don't know if you, any of you were there.
Only Cruz was here.
I'm sure none of you were there. But anyway, I'm here today just to show our support from the school, but also tell you a little bit about what goes into the preparation of the people that that do this such important work. We prepare master's level social workers around the state, and since 2011, we've had a school social work specialization that leads to the Teacher Standard and Practices Commission, TSPC, initial school social work license. Social workers are trained to assess and intervene, as has been described so beautifully, the individual, family, community, and organizational levels, and to provide linkages between these sectors for student success. Our program aims to prepare graduates for initial school social work licensing and for effective professional practice as school social workers. It's guided by an ecological framework, social work values, and a commitment to culturally responsive, effective, and efficient practice. The school social worker curriculum is designed to build competencies relating to working with vulnerable schools, families, students, communities, and the larger society. The aim of school social work is to improve educational outcomes front and center. By removing structural barriers to learning, increasing collaboration among schools, families, and communities, creating relationships with and among students, families, and communities that will promote positive functioning. In addition, the students complete 1,000 hours of field practicum, 500 hours in a K-12 school setting, and 500 hours in some other community-based setting that serves children, youth, and families. School social workers are the key to a multi-tiered system of support. As collaborators with other professionals, which really is the state of the art, they are situated to address school culture as well as the individual, family, and community issues that impact school success. I think everything else I was going to say has been well stated, so to cut time short, I'll just say we wholeheartedly support this. Thank you for sponsoring the bill, and we very much hope that you'll join us in bringing more social workers to serve the needs of children, youth, and families.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Karen Apgar. I'm a school psychologist from Eugene, and I'm also on the executive board of the Oregon School Psychologist Association and of the National Association of School Psychologists. And when we saw that this bill was coming forward, we took a look at it and said, you know, what's really being highlighted in this bill is the importance of promoting a positive school climate for students. Obviously, as well as teachers and families, but specifically for students. And school climate also happens to be one of the things highlighted in the Every Student Succeeds Act at the federal level. So I wanted to just highlight for you, and I've pointed this out in my testimony, that the framework for safe and successful schools was actually a joint document written by the American Association of School Counselors, the National Association for School Psychologists, and the School Social Worker Association of America, in recognizing that all three of our professions are school-based mental health professionals, and that in order to have an improved school climate, the inclusion of all of those professionals, or any of them that you can get, is going to be beneficial to students. My written testimony will show that there's research showing that improving school climate can increase reading and math and writing scores, reduce high school dropouts, reduce suspensions, reduce bullying, decrease behavior problems, decrease absences, and overall increase the performance of students both socially, emotionally, as well as academically in the school setting. As I said, I am a school psychologist in Eugene, and like school social workers, I am a school-based mental health provider, and I see that the impacts that the school climate can have on our students of all ages. A child who feels welcome and safe and genuinely cared for in the school system is a child who wants to attend school, who wants to do the work you've set out for them, and who wants to participate and be part of the school community. All of these factors will increase all of these outcomes that I already noted, but there aren't enough of us. There aren't enough of us out there. A full-time school psychologist in my district, Eugene School District, may be assigned 3 or 4 different schools. So, for instance, one of my schools has 500 children in it. Over 50% are free and reduced lunch. Several are homeless. Many have incarcerated parents or live with drugs in the household. But I can only be there 1 to 2 days a week. The school counselor can only be there 3 days a week, and we have no school social worker. So that's 500 children who need a lot of help in order just to be successful, what we would consider a traditional student. And there's not enough of us to help them. So I feel that this bill and any similar bills that could increase the number of school-based mental health professionals in the school can only be a good thing. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you all
thank
for
you.
Being here. Really appreciate it. There's no one else on our list, so we're going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 278, and we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 706. And with that, we're going to open that hearing, and we'll have a short explanation of the bill. And then, Ford, you want to come up? You can. We can actually have Gary Peterson, Ford, and Rich is on the phone. So come on up if you want while she's giving a short explanation, then I'll have a statement too.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 706 creates a pilot program and is administered by the Oregon Department of Education and consisting of at least one education service district to provide professional development and instructional resources. The bill establishes program requirements, requires ESDs to employ at least 4 coordinator specialists to provide regional professional development and technical assistance. The 4 specialists must be assigned to subject areas, 1 each to mathematics, science, English, and social studies. It requires ESDs to coordinate with component school districts to assign teacher team leaders. It requires ESDs to coordinate with regional partnerships to provide science, technology, engineering, and mathematics education. It requires ESDs to maintain websites with resources and calendars for professional development. Sunsets the pilot program January 2nd, 2020. The bill declares an emergency effective on passage.
So Ford's up here, and I just want to say a couple words. I met Ford for the first time when he was the recipient of the Milken Award for teaching, and I was the Milken Award winner for administrators, and we actually got to know each other a little bit that time. There were a couple other teachers that were in that group. He retired after 33 years of science education. He taught the North Clackamas School District for a lot of that time and was a presidential awardee in science teaching in 94. He also served as a regional science coordinator in the ESD 112, which is Vancouver, Washington, for 2 years, and was a founding member of the Teacher Advisory Council for National Academy of Sciences. So it's really when he came and talked to me about what he wanted to do to help Oregon advance its science and mathematics and STEM and other education, I took it seriously, and this is the outcome of some work that he's done his whole life. So with that, Ford, do you want to start off, and we need to call our person from Washington?
Yes. Yes. Thank you, Chair, and the committee for listening to my testimony today. I have been going through a lot of cuts as I've been trying to try to filter things so that I wasn't going to take up too much time. I think speaking from my own heart is probably going to make more of a difference for you to understand exactly what's happened in Washington State. Rich McBride is the superintendent at North Central ESD in Washington, and he's going to provide some needed perspective about the transition that Washington legislature went through in making decisions to establish this model in Washington State. But let me just comment that in Oregon, the ESDs currently aren't necessarily poised to deliver the kind of instructional services and support for K-12 teachers at this time. And these services, while the service contracts have been established every year, and traditionally they have kind of fallen into the category of special education, early childhood, computer services, and alternative education, they have not really ever addressed the specific needs for K-12 teachers in the classroom that are subject specific. So without specialists who can provide instructional expertise and deliver sustained ongoing professional development for these teachers who will not effectively change instructional practice needed to continuously improve student learning. So my experience in Washington State as the coordinator in 2 years, I became keenly aware of that network and structure. So to give you a piece of
some of the daily responsibilities that a coordinator was responsible for. I worked with 30 school districts in Southwest Washington. My area was about over 300 square miles from Iwaka, Washington to almost Goldendale to north to Castle Rock. So in that area, I mean, I may be kind of good, but I'm not that good at delivering science instruction. So how can any coordinator, regardless of whether it's science, math, English, language arts, be able to effectively deliver and provide leadership and guidance on how teachers are going to bring this kind of instructional practice and needed instructional resources to their teachers as well as to the students? So what I think you should understand from my experience was looking at how can we utilize dollars or leverage dollars to the best that we could, that we're going to benefit our school districts in a way that they could be very, very frugal and efficient about how to use them. The problem is that many times the expertise on making decisions about budgets aren't necessarily falling into the hands of the practitioners and reside more oftentimes with administrators and the school boards. What was different about Washington State is I became aware of not only the network of the eight other ESD coordinators in science, math, and English language arts, but in my region, as in all the other nine ESD regions, there were also teacher leader networks. These teacher leaders represented the schools of every school district and every ESD region. And it was those specialists that were within the district that played a pivotal role not only to delivering the kinds of instructional support and professional development that I was talking about, that a coordinator guides and schedules three times a year and provides that sort of expertise for these leaders, but it enables them to go back to their school districts and extend that network so that there is more of a seamless approach to the delivery of instructional resources and instructional professional development. I want you to also know that there's a seamless connection between OSPI, national organizations such as ACHIEVE in terms of science standards, Common Core in terms of math and English language arts. So all of these groups work together, and you should also note that the nine coordinators develop all these instructional materials and vet all of these instructional materials among all nine of them in conjunction with OSPI and these national organizations I just stated. So it kind of raises the question, why should Oregon adopt this model? And I kept thinking about that while I served as a regional science coordinator in Washington State, because I knew it did not exist in Oregon, the same structure that I was seeing, participating in, and benefiting from as a educational professional. So instruction today is different than instruction used to be years ago. And instructional skills and practice to serve the learning needs of students is not only becoming more specialized, but some of those instructional strategies haven't even been developed yet. So who will lead the change of instruction for these teachers? And I think that for the majority of school districts in Oregon, they're not poised to do that. But ESDs are positioned to do that. Yet they do lack the resources and the experts to be able to do this and provide that service for them. So I think in terms of Senate Bill 706, this is really key in providing the same structure and the same model that Washington State has successfully done for almost a decade now. But it also raises another question, that who's going to deliver this instructional support? And despite the fact that Oregon Department of Education provides education outreach and guidance in terms of a variety of things, Common Core to be one of them, and national the NGSS Next Generation Science Standards, but there also needs to be a greater specificity to meet the needs of rural school districts. So I'm really concerned that rural school districts lack the kind of expertise and funding that is necessary to bring this kind of resource and structure where it is really needed, where it is needed logistically close to those school districts rather than having to go miles and miles to Salem, Eugene, or some other urban, suburban school district to get that help. Other kinds of benefits would be to strengthen teaching practices which meet the needs of diverse learners, all kinds of special education, those that we consider to fall under equity, reduce costs overall in terms of school districts not having to duplicate this kind of a structure and instructional delivery, but instead it reduced costs because it's a shared expense and there's reduced administrative oversight. It facilitates a number of partnerships that school districts may not be able to bring, particularly, again, in the rural school districts, with Oregon Department of Education, other organizations, higher education, and other agencies that typically work with a variety of school districts, but not necessarily each one formally. And it builds this infrastructure, which I think is important, because the STEM hubs, the regional STEM hubs in Oregon, all 11 of them, have various charters in terms of how they approach to meet the needs of their local regions. However, they don't have an infrastructure to deliver STEM instruction or any kinds of professional development, and the specialists can certainly do that. And this is another example of STEM, like equity instruction, like CTE. These can be taught across all subject areas, and again, it could be done because you have all four of those specialists at the ESD. So given the range of what 19 ESDs in Oregon attempt to do versus the 9 ESDs in Washington State, I'm not going to convince you that we need to reduce the number of ESDs down to 9. However, what I am going to say is that by funding and putting into law a pilot of one ESD is certainly going to demonstrate how this model structure could work. And I think not only lessons learned, but the wisdom of practice that results from this pilot would be shared with other ESDs, so they may try to build and benefit from the same sort of wisdom of practice, as I said, that this particular pilot is able to generate. And I also think more than ever, as education policy changes and continues to shape our teaching and learning, I think it's more critical that these teacher leaders are going to be needed to be able to translate education policy into instruction. So I really ask you to support this bill. And at this time, I'd like to refer Rich McBride from Washington ESD to comment about the perspective up there. Rich, I hope you're here.
Hi, Rich. Are you on the phone?
We are indeed. Thank you. Thank you very much, Board, and Honorable Chair and members of the committee. It's a pleasure to join you and to meet you, albeit virtually, this afternoon.
So our question is just to explain how it's going and what you believe to be the successes of having this network developed in Washington.
Absolutely. Well, Ford has provided, I think, an extraordinary extraordinary overview. What I think maybe I can share with you, at least from our, not only our Washington experience, but from, I shared with Ford that I've just finished a year as the immediate past president of our national ESD association, and so I can share with you that this same PD model has been time proven in several states across our country. And by way of a little bit of background, in Washington State, we had two moments in time in which this particular professional development model had its genesis. One was in the early 2000s. Shortly after the tech bubble, in which both states and local school districts experienced, a pretty substantial strain on their finances. The same happened, of course, during the Great Recession of 2007 through 2009. And probably as in Oregon, it certainly happened in Washington, we go through times when resources can be challenged. And so it became very obvious during these two moments in time in our state that professional development, if it was going to occur in its traditional format, i.e. Teachers going on campus during the summer or during the school year, or even departments of education with struggling budgets to try and deliver quality professional development on a statewide scale was going to be very difficult. And really that's when, at least in the state of Washington, our state legislature turned, and our state superintendent, quite frankly, turned to our network of ESDs and said, can you assist us in helping develop, quite frankly, a very strong professional development model? And as Ford alluded to, not only would it be strong, but it would be very effective, it would be very efficient, and probably most important of all, could it be equitable, that we could get quality professional development in our large urban districts, our middle-sized districts, and especially our most rural and small districts, and probably as in Oregon, the vast majority of our school districts of the 296 in Washington State, two-thirds of those are very small. In other words, enrollments under 1,200 or under 1,000 students. And so equity professional development, and especially high-quality professional development was for it was important. The legislature turned to us, said, can you help us take this to scale? And so there was certainly a financial aspect of this, but I also want to turn, you know, quickly to another important perspective that we have all come to understand, and I've seen this in other states as well as I've traveled the country. bless you. The way that professional development is delivered today has gone through a pretty substantial shift in the last several years. You know, the older model of teachers going to summer school, going on college campus, those kinds of things. What we call basically, you know, we used to call them drive-by professional development, where you had to put consultants come into town and then leave. We know that those are neither effective nor efficient. What really is efficient is high-quality professional development in real time, on my time, in close geographic proximity to us, somebody walking beside me in my district, in my classrooms on an ongoing basis. And that's really what ESDs or service agencies do really, really well. And so it has a financial component, yes, but it is also reflecting how professional development is changing. And so, you know, my compliments to you and the committee and to Ford for, you know, your consideration of this kind of a pilot, because as a quick sidebar, I shared with Ford that in my background in history, I also spent two decades as a local school district superintendent in school districts large and small in Washington State. And one thing I can share with you that from my experience in the field over those many years is that when local school district budgets get tight, we did everything we could to maintain, you know, our staff, maintain our take care of our buildings, make care of our transportation fleets and all those things. And so the one thing that got cut virtually every time was our professional development. And so in this particular moment in time, you know, I shared with Mark, when resources are plentiful, you know, we rarely look at more effective and efficient ways to do things. When resources get tight, and that's why I pointed out the two moments in time in Washington that we experienced the financial shortfall, that was the time when the legislature and our state superintendent turned to their service districts and said, you know, can we innovate? Can we find ways to be more effective and creative? And so my compliments to you for considering this, you know, this investment, if you will, at a time when we know that that certainly resources, you know, can be a challenge. So, Ford, I'll stop there. Mr. Chair, I'll stop there. I'm happy if there are questions. Glad to share any additional thoughts.
Thank you, Rich.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? And I'll probably be looking at it and maybe getting more information at times. And I appreciate knowing you as a resource to look into it deeper. This has been an issue since I've been in Oregon from Washington, where I went to high school. Is trying to figure out how do we get subject-specific, high-quality staff development to our schools. Because when I first got here, there was a good group of math and science professionals at the department, and I could ask them for help, and that worked pretty well. But then as time went on and resources got tight, even the ESDs and the State Department started not having those same experts. So figuring out how to develop that again at the ESDs so that they're close enough to get the information, I think would be really helpful. I know every teacher I worked with was always looking for those assets. So thank you very much.
Absolutely. Yeah, my pleasure, and my colleagues and I in Washington, of course, we stand ready to assist or to help. There's not, you know, as I mentioned before, there's not a necessity to reinvent the wheel. We are most happy to share what we have learned, both good and bad, and make sure that we're being a key resource for you. So again, my compliments. Thank you for letting me be a part of your hearing today.
Thank you very much. And is Gary Peterson here? Come on up, Gary, and we'll hear from you for a few minutes. And keep it fairly tight as you can. So we're running out of time for a few more bills.
I can talk fast.
We're going to say goodbye, Rich. So we'll
thank you very much.
Thank you.
Nice to meet you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, I did submit some remarks in advance, and so I'll do some quick summary of comment, a couple uh, concerns and then a suggestion. Comment would be, I think, that to make sure that there's not a misconception about the role of education service districts in professional development. That is a part of what we do. We've been doing it. We have facilities. We have facilitators. We have the structure in place to do that. And I think just a quick example of that, Ford alluded to the Next Generation Science Standards and the implementation of those throughout the state. My daughter is a second-year teacher in Molalla River School District in the southern part of Clackamas County, and so asking her about the implementation of the Next Generation Science Standards, and she's part of their district STEM team, and she said, well, it's going pretty well. And I said, well, who is providing the resource, the background for that, trying to get to your point, Chair Roblin, about is ODE taking the lead or that? Who's providing that background information? And she said it's provided by the Education Services, by the ESD on their own. Now, I think that begs the question of how can the state do that in a more organized fashion, and I think certainly Senate Bill 706 has a potential to lead in that direction at some point. The pilot that wouldn't do that, but at some point, how that can that be coordinated? Two concerns that the Education Service District would raise. One is that we do believe that within the existing structure, our local service planning structure, that there is a provision where we could get to the model that's being proposed without legislation. So just to put that out there, because we do have an annual conversation with our local school districts about how what they would like to see, and certainly professional development is usually and often a part of that, although as you well understand, we compete for funds in that basis, how that works. Second part of that is just we're concerned that funding for this would not come from existing funds, i.e. we wouldn't, we'd prefer that you didn't say, well, you're going to use part of your local service plan dollars to designate this particular pilot, and so that would be the concern. Finally, the suggestion for you would be Senate Bill 182 is real, and there are several lines in Senate Bill 182, I highlighted them in my testimony, that relate specifically to the purposes of professional development that are aligned with what Senate Bill 706 expects in terms of support for instruction and support in the academic content areas. And I would encourage you to take a look at how the merger of those two might look, and from the ESD perspective, how we can partner with that, looking at it from a collaborative statewide effort on concert with ODE to make sure that we reach every district in the state, because we have that access through the ESD system. So with that, summarize it to what I have to say.
Thank you very much. I will ask you only one question. It seems that Washington has more people, maybe a little less space, and 9 instead of 17. Do you think?
Senator, I asked you to ask that question.
I know, but we both have the same feeling at times. So, any thoughts about that, in particular about being able to service people, getting more consistent with that conversation? We've had conversations, as you know, about this many times.
Oh yeah, I understand. The interesting, I think, perspective on Oregon ESDs, and to some extent probably Washington originally, is that they came out of the county units for instruction. And so we have the history that draws those along county lines. And that's where I think it gets in the way of looking what is an effective system, what would an effective system look like, as long as we have those county lineage kinds of things. Now, there certainly are models, and if you move into STEM hubs or early learning hubs where they've said, okay, counties or groups of counties, how can you, what's a configuration that works for you? And I think that's a really good conversation to have, because then it's coming not from you folks, no offense, but it's coming from in an organic fashion about who are the partners that can get together and work together effectively, and it may not cross at the county line, and in some cases, and we have that examples with early learning hubs, where it crosses, it skips over counties. It skips over Klamath County and goes to Lake, or Douglas, it skips over one of the counties and goes to Lake, and then so that's a long stretched out region rather than one that might be centered around Douglas County, Senator Cruz's area. So I think there are certainly more efficient options for that, but I think it has to be done carefully, because as you folks well know, there are winners and losers anytime you start doing those sorts of adjustments, and county lines as school district lines are sometimes sacred.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that thoughtful answer, actually.
A couple quick comments. Yep. I also think that Rich would say that in Washington State, those nine ESDs, it's really a challenge for them to really cover those areas. Having been a regional science coordinator, I would also echo that. But at the same time, I do think that if you were to look at the 10th recommendation in particular, the committee that was put out for the Oregon Advancement Education Council, the Governor's Council, that 10th recommendation really focuses on the establishment of regional networks throughout the state. And looking at that structure, I think that there are a lot of potential ways in which I think Senate Bill 706 seems to make sense as far as how it kind of fits with other areas of legislation. So,
thank you very much. Thank you, both of you. There was no one else to speak. I'm going to close the work about informational hearing on Senate Bill 706 and open informational hearing, public hearing, on Senate Bills 395, 396, and 551. And Senator Denbrough, thanks for waiting and being patient. And I figured you might as well be able to talk on all of them. So.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee, I'm Michael Denbrough, the senator for District 23, that's Northeast and Southeast Portland, and really pleased to be here to talk about these bills related to the foster youth of our state. You know, when we look back on our legislative accomplishments, for all of us, other than Senator Linthicum, who hasn't really had a chance to accomplish anything yet, but we know he will. he survived his initial haze, so that's a big thing. No, you know, we have a lot of disappointments and things to feel proud about. And for me, one of the things that I feel proudest of is having helped pass into law House Bill 3471 back in 2011, and that created the program that we came to call the Foster Youth Promise program. And what that did, in some ways it sort of pre-visioned what came to be the Oregon Promise, in that it assured free tuition for students who were former foster youth. And that, in this case, both at the community college level and at the university level. And this was really a case of the institution stepping up at that time. Remember, we were at the heart of the recession, really, still in 2011. And this was a bipartisan bill. My co-chief sponsor was Representative Wingard, who was with us back then. And it came out of a recognition that we had a real problem with our former foster youth in getting them to academic success. National statistics showed that former foster youth were graduating, were completing their programs at less than a 2% rate. Let me look at it the other way, right? I'm sorry, I misspoke, that of former foster youth, less than 2% of them had bachelor's degrees. And for many of them, what that meant was they were locked into a cycle, an ongoing cycle of poverty and fosterhood in many cases. And we recognize that, you know, one of the best ways to break that cycle of foster status is through education. And, you know, the other thing was foster youth have a special relationship with the state, with us as legislators, in fact. You know, they're wards of the state. They are, in many ways, our children. We have taken responsibility for them. And, you know, we know that all our children, when they go to college, they face challenges. And ideally, we're there to help them through that experience. Former foster youth don't have that advantage. And so we need to go out of our way to help them to be successful. This bill, the Bill 3471 back in 2011, actually came to us from a group of former foster youth, the Foster Youth Connection, great group of people. And now it's 5 years, 6 years later, and we don't really have a clear sense of how well the program is working. Anecdotally, we have a sense that it's working well. And, you know, the colleges stepped up to make it a possibility. The universities really stepped up, actually, you know, because with this being a last-dollar program, the most of the tuition for community college was actually being covered by Pell Grants and the, you know, other state aid. But for the universities, it was a real commitment. I really, you know, I still admire their taking that on. But we don't really, we don't have an ongoing sense of how many of our students at community college and at university are foster youth, former foster youth, and how well they're doing. You know, our hope was that the tuition remissions would help with their success. So what Senate Bill 395 does, sorry, this is a long introduction to get into the actual substance of the bills. Senate Bill 395 directs the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission, working with the Department of Human Services. And sorry, if you look at the bill as introduced, somehow DHS became OHSU. I mean, they have an HS in common, but aside from that, I'm not quite sure how that happened. But I think we have an amendment that fixes that. Anyway, because DHS, of course, is the connector with these youth. So working with them to identify the students and to be able to have a clear sense of how many are enrolled and how they are persisting, how they are graduating, and making that actually part of the ongoing evaluations of the institutions to see how well they are doing in addressing the needs of our former foster youth. So that's what Senate Bill 395 does. Senate Bill 396 addresses, so we actually had another part of the foster youth promise bill. It wasn't just the tuition remission, but there was also a kind of an expectation. It wasn't a requirement, but it was an expectation that the students who were receiving these awards would sort of pay it back, pay it forward, by being part of success centers at the campuses where they could do peer support or be mentors to high school foster youth to show them that there's a path for them. They can go to college and you know, be like the mentor. And, you know, our hope was that the different institutions would create these success centers. Of course, it being 2011, we didn't give them any money to do that, but we indicated some hope that that would happen. And I will say, I'm very proud to say that a couple of our institutions have stepped up to do that, most notably my own, Portland Community College. And we have one of the board members here, Michael Sonleitner, and you'll be hearing from some others who are involved in what they've been doing. And Western Oregon University has also been doing some great things with former foster youth. What Senate Bill 396 does, and I should preface this by saying this bill, as well as the next bill, were drafted in, what should I call it, a pre-Measure 97 environment, when we were hoping that we would be in a very different place than we were in 2011, but that would give the institutions support to be able to go ahead and create these success centers, which, you know, I believe, I think many of us believe, really are vital to the success of former foster youth. And you'll hear some stories about that. The final bill, Senate Bill 551, is addressing the challenge that foster youth have challenges just being in school. But they have additional challenges when they want to transfer from the community college to the university. That transition is hard for them. In some cases, they are moving to another town, another city. moving away from their support network. For all students, that first term after the transfer is a difficult one. And that's even more the case, I think, for foster youth, again, because of the particular challenges that they face with housing, with all sorts of things. So what Senate Bill 551 does, it calls for the creation of a pilot project where a college and a university would pair up to have really heightened coordination of that transfer so that people from the university would be interacting with former foster youth while they're still at the community college, and there would be ongoing relationships between the two of them. And I know that there's been there's interest in this at Portland Community College, Portland State University, and there's a natural transfer connection there, obviously from PCC to PSU, but for many students, community college students or former foster youth, there's a benefit for them also to experience that other, a more rural environment. So you wouldn't want to just lock them into a transfer from the urban college to the urban university, but a relationship with a more rural university, a small regional, could be of value too. So that's kind of what we were envisioning there. So that's what these bills do. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and you'll be hearing from some foster youth themselves, I know that you'll enjoy what you hear.
Senator Lippincott.
You made allusion to pre-97, and I appreciate you shedding light on that. In terms of having an evidence-based program, data-driven model, I like the idea of gathering the statistics, i.e. 395, and I'm a little hesitant to establish a Foster Youth Success Center 396 and also implement this transition in your example from PCC to PSU and in Klamath, from Klamath Community College to Oregon Tech or even out to PSU and those kinds of things without knowing what we're looking at. So I'm curious if you can shed light on why continue to advance all three of these. Why not just focus on 395 and leave 96 and 551 in the background until we know what the story looks like?
I think that's a fair question. I'll just say that you'll be hearing from people that will, I think, totally convince you to empty out your wallet and fund all three. But if at the end of the day only one of them moves forward, in baseball, a .330 batting average is not bad.
Actually, that could solve the budget problem.
Yeah. We face a real problem. So
of course.
You. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you.
So with that, we're going to have Lisa J. Finesse. I'll let her say however we say it. I can't read regular names, so it's harder when you give me other help. And Neil, is it Nagas?
Negus.
For a dyslexic person, when you put extra things in there, it just gets really hard.
I
it was hard to begin
share
with.
Share that problem. And these similar names are going to kill me.
Right? No problem. You can call me anything you want. Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you. Chair Oblin, members of the committee, it's always very difficult to follow Senator Dembro, and he pretty well laid out the whole picture. But I thank you for your time and the opportunity to tell you a little bit about what we're doing at Portland Community College and our Fostering Success Program. At PCC, we're taking a leadership role for community colleges in the state by providing specialist Lisa, who can provide support and increase the retention of foster youth at PCC. We're establishing what we're calling a support network with PCC, our community partners, and especially Department of Human Services, and as you'll hear a little bit later, Western Oregon University. As you know, community colleges are often the primary point of entry for foster youth to higher education. And again, as Senator Denbro mentioned, we really appreciate you all your support in passing the Foster Youth Promise. But as he mentioned also, statistics show that not more than 3% of foster youth that attempt to go to college ever successfully complete. So the money is important, but it's not the answer, not the total answer. They need additional ongoing support at the colleges that they do attend. And again, getting to the point of identifying foster youth, Senate Bill 395 is really important because it's really difficult for us to identify who the foster youth are. And having information and data from the Department of Human Services would help a lot. Currently at Portland Community College, we have a checkbox on our college application for foster youth or former foster youth to check the box to voluntarily identify whether or not they've been in care. For the fall term, we had 290 students check the box. For the winter term, we had 190 students check the box. And those are only the ones that volunteered, so we really don't know what the total numbers are. Besides supporting students, Lisa has been training individuals around PCC that we're calling champions, so that we have people in various departments, including financial aid, advising, counseling, some faculty members, who are trained to help understand the issues foster youth bring to college and to be able to support them. But it's really important to get that information early so we can intervene earlier with students and identify what the real issues are. And this, the individuals, the champions that are being trained are being given this emblem, this little logo, so that when foster youth see this in their offices, on their desks, on their buttons, they know it's a safe, supportive place that they can go to get help that they need. We're also working on establishing foster youth days at PCC. We had one last summer. We have a few this summer to bring foster youth onto college to help prepare them before they actually start. And I think this has been a big help to the independent living program coordinators as well. And it makes their job of transitioning youth from foster care into college a little bit easier. So we do urge support of all three bills, Senate Bills 395, 396, and 551. We do need to find out the data. We do need to know how many students there are and where they're attending school. But we also need to establish good quality centers to be able to improve the outcomes of those students. And these bills will not only help fostering success, but it will help create a statewide initiative similar to those in other states like California, Washington, Michigan, that have been successful in improving the outcomes of foster youth at their colleges and universities. So thank you for your time, and Lisa.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lisa Jean Phoenix, and I am the program coordinator for the PCC Fostering Success Program. I'm here today in my professional role and also as a former foster youth. I entered the system when I was 8, although I was really a ward of the court at age 6, but I hadn't been taken away yet. My mother suffered from severe mental illness, and in the early testimony that the social workers gave, they described certain children, and I was exactly one of those children. I bumped in and out of foster care from 8 until I ran away when I was almost 16. After I ran away, the courts emancipated me. I didn't know it at the time. I wish I had known, but anyway, I was emancipated. And that left me at 16 years old to be an adult and transition into adulthood without any family support. My mom was in an institution at the time, and my father was an absentee father. At 17, I became a mom, and that was the impetus for me to change my life. And so I went back to school, and I got my GED, and I went straight through really facing a lot of challenges along the way, but I eventually got my PhD in neurobiology and behavior from the University of Washington in Seattle. So I am an example of the possibilities, right, that foster youth can be successful and to break the cycle. My daughter is now 32 years old, and she is a social worker in Portland, right? So she didn't end up in foster care, although my history was that my mother had also been taken from the home and have almost the same worse history. So breaking the cycle is important, and that's what we're here to do today. As you heard, tracking success is really important, and I am coming here from Michigan, and Michigan is one of the leaders in shifting college retention rates and graduation rates for current and former foster youth. And there are a large number of centers around the states. And from that, I know what some of the best practices are to actually get these programs to be successful. And having centers where you have staff, dedicated staff that can have very frequent contact with these youth, where you have basically the funding, because it does take funding to provide many of the same supports that families would provide. So I was lacking in that. So I ended up homeless and living in a tent while I was going to college with my baby, because I didn't have anyone to help me put down deposits on a house to help me pay for an emergency. Even when I got a house, I didn't have the money to pay the deposits for the utilities. So we ate cold food, and I gave my daughter cold baths. So this is the reality for people who have zero family support. And I persevered, you know, for my daughter, I persevered. But it's very hard. And I know that without support, based off of what I've seen in these other programs, we know that good supports do shift those success rates. And we really would like to, we've done a lot so far to implement those best practices. We would like to expand and be able to do more for our students. And we've been developing, again, that pipeline to help them transition from the community college into a four-year program. And not all of them will do that. The nice thing about being as a community college is I can also help them. If traditional academic isn't good, they can go into a vocational program because the community colleges have them. So I really feel like the centers at the community college are very important because they serve a wide range of foster youth who are going to have different pathways to success. So I'm here to support all of these bills, and I think that with your commitment, you can help break those cycles and really make a difference. You know, that you would have more individuals like me that are able to sit here and say, I was a success, as opposed to ending up in prison, ending up on public dole, ending up with basically all of those negative, what the statistics say are going to happen. And I know for a fact it doesn't have to happen, and we can all join together to do more for that. So I think that's all I have.
Any questions? Thank you very much. I want to thank you in particular for actually being a Husky. I was also, and it's hard being a duck here in this kind
purple.
Of state. Yeah, I saw that. I was impressed. So. And secondly, that you were willing to share a story that I think is one that needs to be shared so that these kids have an understanding that they too could aspire to. So thank you for that too. Thanks.
Thank you.
Next we have Stephanie Villalobos and Emily Peel. Oh, or Black. Oh, and Bo Cornig. Thank you all for being here.
Thanks. Bo, do you want to go first since you're with the PCC folks?
I'm with PSU. Sure, I'll go first. Chair Roblin and members of the Senate Education Committee. For the record, my name is Bo Coring, and I am a junior at Portland State University studying communication. I'm here to speak in support of SB 395, 396, and 551, which support former foster youth in higher education. As a former foster youth, I believe these three bills will help me and other foster youth succeed in higher education. I support SB 395 because it can be used to count the number of former foster youth attending community college and universities. My concern with this is the potential to use these numbers to justify not providing necessary resources that could be provided by a student center. I would also like to count the current foster youth because you can remain in foster care until you are the age of 21. I support SB 396 because by giving space to foster youth, it will provide a place to discuss issues related to foster care, such as the foster care system, grants, resources, studying, making friends, future connections, planning events, and other advocacy. Foster care intersects with all identities, oftentimes stripping children of their cultural identity by taking them out of their home. Currently, I work in the Cultural Resources Centers at PSU, and I see the positive effects it has on the students who visit the centers, and it is oftentimes the same people I see every day. I believe by providing this kind of space to those who have experienced foster care, that it will help foster youth flourish into strong leaders and amplify their voices and increase advocacy on behalf of foster youth from foster youth. By establishing these centers, you'd be prioritizing people who often slip through the cracks. With only around 3% of foster youth completing a bachelor's degree, there is an immediate need to address the issues around foster youth and retention. Foster youth often qualify for federal Pell Grant, Oregon Opportunity Grant, Chaffee Grant, and federal work study. But with the graduation rate the way it is, it's apparent that it's not only money that is needed to complete a degree. However, it is still very important. Not only would you be helping students by providing them a space, but you would also make better use of grant money by reducing the dropout rate. And for SB 551, I support this because I believe there is a need to help foster youth transition from community college to university. I have made this transition, and if it wasn't for my experience in student leadership and my involvement on campus, I don't think I would have had the confidence to actually make the adjustment. However, not all foster youth have the same opportunities, so I believe it's really important to create a pilot program that would encourage this. Currently, I am creating a group at PSU for foster youth, and I'm also working with people at Portland Community College to also establish a club for foster youth as an informal way to make that connection. So by adding this pilot program, I feel like that would also just increase our efforts. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello and thank you, Chair Roblin and other members of the committee. My name is Stephanie Villalobos. I am a student at Western Oregon University. Apart from being a student, I am also a daughter of two current foster parents. My family has been actively involved with the foster system for 8 years, taking in children from ages 3 to 18. The foster system has been part of my life. I have seen firsthand how the system works. As I frequently notice, it's the lack of support that has caused many to no longer want to proceed with their education. I often hear questions such as, is college an actual possibility for me? How will I pay for college? Who will continue to support me once I'm out of the system? I want you to think about the further support you all received when you wanted to continue your education. Whoever supported you, there was always someone, from helping you out to what classes to select, from obtaining your first place, your first, paying your first rent, figuring out your taxes, your first job interview, whatever support you received to figuring out how to navigate yourself to becoming independent. Now I want to shine light on a current foster student that is currently living in my family. His name is Kevin. When I go home, I always talk to him about all my classes. He is super enthusiastic about college. However, he is about to age out of the system, but he does not see college being a possibility for him. Why? Because of the lack of support. Which leads to the approval of these bills. And with the Foster Youth Promise Support Program, foster alumni are able to receive further support in their education and in becoming successful. I'm here today to testify for these bills because I personally seen the issues that arise with some of my family's current foster children who are about to age out of the system and wonder what other support will come in regards to furthering their education. I personally believe with these programs enacted in other universities and community colleges, this will allow other foster alumni to progress in their education. This continuous support will also allow many to change their perspectives in regards to furthering their education, knowing that they will have the security of the support throughout their college experience. Please support Senate Bill 396. Respectfully, thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Linthicum, and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 395, 396, and 551. I'm also here to recruit Bo to Western Oregon University. And my name is Emily Pleck. I'm a professor of communication studies at Western. I'm also the co-chair of a Fostering Success Initiative, along with our Director of Academic Advising, Karen Sullivan Vance, and our local ILP, Independent Living Program Provider, Shannon Simich. Over the years, I've encountered more students than I can count. It's been 15 years that I've been at Western, and since my first year, I began in my introductory public speaking classes, that dreaded first year public speaking class, to find and meet students who were so passionate about the foster care system, who had experienced it firsthand and felt an intense desire to improve and expand upon the experiences that they had had, and who made it to college despite all of the barriers in front of them and not because of the support that they received. This is not an insignificant student population, and in fact, they do have all of the barriers that other disadvantaged student populations face, plus some that I had never really even thought about until I began to be educated on the issue. Things like family privilege, exposure gaps, ACEs, which you heard about earlier, trauma, transitions. All of those barriers, though, as Lisa testified, can be overcome with the right structures and opportunities, and all of our evidence suggests that provided those, foster students are willing to do the hard work in order to succeed educationally. As Beau mentioned, money is an issue, but it's not the issue, and it's one that we have a pretty good handle on thanks to the work of the legislature in 2011 and to support programs like the Chafee Benefits. So I applaud the legislature for addressing some of these big issues, like the financial ones, but now we need to step up our game and we need your support to do this. Support is the issue. We know that the one thing that will ensure the large population of the foster students who walk through our classroom doors will walk across that commencement platform 4 to 5 years later with their degrees is, frankly, Alisa Phoenix. It's a Shannon Simich, my co-chair in ILP, or Lydia Sturba, a WU graduate who was Shannon's student, who also went on to become an ILP and serve students in their transition to higher education. It's not just an office or a position or maybe two or three, but it's having the resources, the authority, and the incentive to really engage the campus community and our foster alumni, as Senator Dembro mentioned, and do that hard work of reaching back into the junior highs and high schools when kids should be thinking about and considering and preparing for college, which is hard to do if you're being moved from one high school to another to another. A lot of the infrastructure already exists. We have what we need in place at Western Oregon University, with the exception of a foster alumnus who can provide that wraparound service and support. I'm simply lobbying you to incentivize the streamlining and the enhancing of it. I know that we are doing a fraction of what we are capable of doing at Western Oregon University if we had the resources, because we're doing it in the spare time of three individuals who have full-time jobs and a 10-hour-a-week student intern. So we're accomplishing what we've accomplished at Western with a small bit of financial help from our DHS partners and a lot of hard work on the part of people who are volunteering their time. If you make this investment now, even in a limited capacity through a piloting of a program at a community college, a 4-year urban campus, a 4-year mid-sized regional campus, I am convinced that you will see the outcomes in just a few years. We all know what is at stake if we fail to make the investments on the front end. They come in on the back end, in welfare, in our criminal justice spending, in healthcare and health services. And the lives of those students are no better for those back end expenditures. Education works on the front end, it breaks the cycles, it changes futures. I also get to see the speeches in their dreaded first year public speaking class, but I also get to see them on the commencement stage a few years later and to hug them when they graduate. I'm convinced that we can make those foster students, the graduates, not an if but a when and a norm rather than the exception if we dedicate ourselves to doing it. Thank you for your consideration, and I hope your support of Senate Bill 395, 396, and 551.
Any questions for this panel? Yes.
Am I allowed to make a follow-up comment?
I think we'll have room for you, so we'll let these people go, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we're going to call up Chris Vogel, Kyle Thomas, and you. So you get to have the final word after these other people.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chris Vogel. I'm the Education Policy Coordinator for the League of Women Voters. You have my written testimony. I won't go over that. I did do some investigation and some asking about what does it take to fund this at this point. And I was told it's about a 0.5 FTE at each of the universities or community colleges. At this point, You heard Senator Dembrough say that he would be willing to start small and grow larger. We know that this is a population that has a very, very high risk potential, and this program can help with that. That is my league testimony. I'm now taking off that badge. My name is Chris Vogel. I'm a resident of Salem, Oregon. I am also the foster parent and the adoptive parent of four folks who are now young adults who started life with abuse, neglect, and fetal drug exposure. I've lived this era. I know that students who age out of foster care often lack even the basics of a Social Security card and other things to move forward. We also know that people in foster care are often delayed socially and emotionally by the number of years that they spend in those programs. So we may have a chronological 18-year-old who is really a 14-year-old as they start through this community college system. And it is a very good investment for the state, even in these very short budget times, to take incremental steps to be able to continue forward with this. Thank you.
Thank you. Won't charge it for two people.
Senator Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Kyle Thomas. I'm the Director of Legislative and Policy Affairs for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Good afternoon. I'm not here to comment on the substance or the need for additional supports for foster students at colleges. I think that it is undeniable that students come from those circumstances in that particular population. And if the gentleman from YDC came up and testified, they would provide better data than the HEC has about the need to provide additional supports for these students. I'm simply here to comment on the role of the HEC as it appears in Senate Bill 396 and 551. And I just lost my testimony. Hold on. So HEC is very good at coordinating activities between campuses, providing policymakers with neutral information, analyzing data on effectiveness of programs. What the HEC has traditionally not yet really involved itself in at this point in its existence is the establishment of and the administration of academic and student support programs on individual campuses. And so should these bills move forward this session or in a future session, I just advise the committee to ask whether or not the appearance of HEC in this capacity as it relates to these particular bills is in fact additive, or whether or not the individual campuses should be the entity that establishes and administers the support programs at this level. And with regard to Senate Bill 551 specifically, I'd point to Senate Bill 860 from 2015, which was in fact a mentoring pilot program that the HEC operated by receiving applications from campuses to run the mentoring program and then issued essentially a grant to campuses that proposed the best ideas. So as you look at 551 and its pilot that envisions a transfer support system between two institutions, it may in fact be better to have the HEC receive those applications for a program that has been designed by two campuses, clearly with expertise on those campuses. You heard a little bit about how the program operates at PCC, and operate the program that way. I think that if you'll do so, you'll find that there's the potential to reduce the administrative costs that might otherwise be present by including the HEC in a more direct role.
Thank you very much.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Lisa Phoenix again. I just want to comment in terms of thinking about the design. I understand that there are fiscal considerations. We're all very aware of that. But as we're thinking about these programs, you know, I think that the consideration of even pilot programs is really important to begin this work. And I just, again, want to highlight it from my own personal story. So, you know, when I ran away from foster care, I was in an urban environment, surrounded by, you know, the per capita income was $14,000 a year. A lot of people took to crime in order to fund themselves. This is not a positive environment in order to pursue education in. And so after 2 years of really struggling in that environment, I applied to transfer to a rural campus. And I will tell you that it was it was almost even serendipity that got that to happen. And it was the best thing that could have ever happened to me. If that had not happened, I would have continued to be in the environment that would have perpetuated the history that my family had been through for generations. And so I think this is so critical to understand that as we're thinking about why do we need these programs at a lot of colleges? Well, part of it is yes, it's scary to leave, and I was scared to leave. And I had never been on a plane, and I put my baby in the three changes of clothes that I owned. I got on a plane, I got off a plane, and I moved into a tent, right? So this shouldn't happen, right? It's support, right? I shouldn't have had to make those kind of choices. And so I just really, again, would like to, I know that there are fiscal considerations, but I think we can begin this work, and the work is so important, and the outcome is so amazing, right? I cry when I think about my daughter when she graduated college, and that I did that, I could support her to not end up like the rest of my family. So thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, I did want to add one more comment. If you look through the details of the bill, as our analyst has noted, there is a component of the combined bills that ask HEC to look at coordinating private fundraising efforts for this. There, I believe, is a large philanthropic interest in foster care throughout the state. I know that many of our philanthropic organizations have taken the lead looking at early learning, looking at at-risk children at that early stage. And I do have some personal information that there are philanthropic funds to do some of this work.
Thank you. Any questions for any of the people here? Thank you all. Is there anyone else we haven't called that is not on our list that would like to speak to this bill or these bills or any one of the bills? There is not a rush. No one is jumping up and down. Okay. So we're going to close our public hearing on Senate Bills 395, 396, and 551. Thank everybody for being here. I don't have anything else on the agenda. We're going to have a conversation about the other bill that we didn't work, and I'll look at looking at a different date. With that?
That's right by one.
Okay. We're going to close our public hearing on. We're going to close our committee of education today on the 23rd.
I'm not
Thanks.
Technologically advanced.
You got to download the app. You got to download the NCAA.
I'm switching to Ernie.
Oh, really?
Oh, the opening for the work session that's Thursday. Yes. My amendment, and that's the day that I'm not. Yes. My amendment, and that's the day that I'm not. Scheduled for the work session.